Secretary Muskie holds a news conference today, his second such formal news conference at the State Department in the last 3 weeks. But that's only one statistic of his obvious determination to be out front, available and visible so far as trying to win understanding and friends for the Carter administration's foreign policy. Earlier this week, he delivered a major speech on U.S. Middle East policy, and he remained in front of the microphones for another 20 minutes or so in a question and answer session with reporters. Also during the week, he stopped to take a few questions from reporters who had staked him out in the diplomatic lobby of the State Department. All of this articulation is not accidental. Muskie wants to be perceived as the spokesman of U.S. foreign policy. To put it undiplomatically, Muskie probably would not object, if anything, that the president's national security advisor, Zbigniew Brzezinski, has to say on foreign policy is regarded as asterisks to what the Secretary of State says. And the reason for that is clear. Under Muskie's predecessor, Cyrus Vance, the administration's foreign policy often sounded as though it had at least two voices, Vance's and Brzezinski's. And this led to confusion and uncertainty, not only at home, but abroad, the result being that the administration was accused of indecisiveness, of a lack of clarity. The fault, obviously, was neither Vance's nor Brzezinski's. Had President Carter wanted a one-voice policy, he could have arranged for it. Now, he apparently has. The voice heard round the land on foreign policy is mostly Muskie's, not Brzezinski's. And Muskie has made no secret that that's the way he likes it. In fact, the other day he noted that he took the job of Secretary of State on the assurance that he would be the foreign policy spokesman. But there's still the question that if one is the foreign policy spokesman, how effective can he be in the few short months between now and Election Day, during a period when foreign policy is often buffeted by the requirements of politics? The feeling among various State Department professionals is that the time period between today and the day the presidential polling booths open in November is simply too abbreviated to launch any serious diplomatic spectaculars. That perhaps the most that can be expected, realistically speaking, is more of the same. If you like the policy, you'll continue liking it. If you don't, you still won't. If the president should be reelected and Muskie stays on as Secretary of State, there's a whole new time frame in which to operate. But that question, of course, will not be answered until November. And the image of Muskie right now, in the view of some foreign affairs specialists, is of a Secretary of State with his finger in the dike, firming up present policy, trying to prevent any floods, and maybe even score some points on behalf of U.S. foreign policy. Now, this message.
Waiter, there's a fly in my soup.
Waiter, there's a fly in my soup.
Oh, those flies, they're ruining my business. But I can't use a pest strip near food.
You need new Black Flag Flyport.
Flyport? What is the Flyport?
Flyport is the new way to kill flies without poison, insecticide odor, or mess.
We can use it near food.
Right. Flyport attracts flies who land, get stuck, and die. Hidden from view. There's no bug fallout.
Oh, fantastic.
New Black Flag Flyport. Lots of arrivals, but no departures.
And no more flies in the soup.
First Line Report, I'm Bernard Kalb, CBS News.
Good morning. This is Dallas Townsend with the CBS World News Roundup. Mount St. Helens has erupted again for the third time in less than a month. Gary Shepard has details in Portland, Oregon.
It began last evening with a plume of steam and volcanic ash rising as much as 50,000 feet into the air, accompanied by an earthquake measuring 3.2 on the Richter scale and harmonic tremors that are still going on. Winds carried the ash to the south, where it fell like a blizzard on Vancouver, Washington, and here in Portland, prompting Mayor Connie McCready to declare a limited state of emergency. The speed limit has been reduced to 15 miles an hour, and residents are being urged to stay indoors to avoid breathing in the light gray powder, which has coated everything. Traffic on Interstate Highway 5, which runs north to Seattle, was slowed considerably by the ash fallout, which reduced visibility to 50 feet in one area. The tiny village of Cougar, 12 miles from Mount St. Helens, was ordered evacuated after pumice the size of marbles began falling. And officials here are worried about ash contaminating this city's reservoir, which supplies drinking water to more than 350,000 people. Gary Shepard, CBS News, Portland, Oregon.
According to the National Weather Service, winds below the 40,000-foot level are generally blowing to the south-southwest. At higher altitudes, though, they're blowing north, and there are scattered reports of very light ash fall in the Seattle-Tacoma area, more than 100 miles north of the volcano. A thunderstorm with winds up to 85 miles an hour struck eastern Nebraska late yesterday, and it may have been a factor in the crash of an Air Wisconsin plane. The commuter flight, carrying 15 people from Minneapolis to Lincoln, Nebraska, plowed into a field near Valley, Nebraska. 12 of those on board were killed. The other three were hospitalized, and one of them is in critical condition. FAA officials in Omaha say the plane went off the radar screen during the thunderstorm. A National Transportation Safety Board team from Washington is due in Omaha today to start listening to tapes of radio traffic between the pilot and air traffic controllers. Leaders of the European Common Market are concluding their two-day conference in Venice, and they're ending it with a Middle East declaration, one that calls for a negotiating role for the Palestine Liberation Organization in peace talks. That proposal is generally viewed as the Common Market's de facto recognition of the PLO. The Europeans emphasize that the move is not intended to undermine the Camp David peace process, but this country's European allies clearly want to follow their own course on the Middle East problem. The Venice Declaration on the Middle East is about to become a factor in Middle Eastern politics at the United Nations, and Richard C. Hotlett reports that it will happen soon.
The Arab states now want a meeting of the UN Security Council on Jerusalem next week and a special session of the UN General Assembly on Palestinian rights next month. On Jerusalem, the nine have long been on record as not accepting any unilateral moves by Israel to change the status of the city. And in this, the Europeans are in full agreement with the United States. President Carter, in March, reaffirmed the American position that, quote, the part of Jerusalem that came under the control of Israel in the 1967 war is occupied territory and subject to the provisions of international law, unquote. The U.S. does not recognize the legality of Israel's annexation of East Jerusalem and says the city's status remains to be determined in the peace negotiations. A resolution which simply reaffirmed that would be hard for the United States to oppose. As to Palestinian rights, there is no veto in the General Assembly, and European support for Palestinian self-determination would simply swell the majority already in favor. Richard C. Hottle at CBS News, United Nations.
A memorial service was held in Tokyo this morning for Japanese Prime Minister Masayoshi Ohira, who died early yesterday of a heart attack at the age of 70. Bruce Dunning was there.
As the small choir sang, friends and colleagues paid homage to the late Prime Minister. One by one, they walked to an altar that held a portrait of Ohira surmounted with a cross of white flowers. As is customary at Japanese Christian funerals, each person laid a single white carnation before the picture as a gesture of tribute. Former Prime Minister Miki, whom Ohira had helped drive from office, Yasuhiro Nakasone, prominently named as a possible successor to Ohira. Each bowed to the Ohira family. One daughter was holding a handkerchief to her eyes. Mrs. Ohira was sitting motionless, dressed in a formal black kimono. A priest prayed, asking eternal peace for the soul of the deceased. The name Ohira means great peace. It was the first service of tribute to the late Prime Minister. The formal family funeral will be held tomorrow. The government has announced that some kind of official memorial service will be held after the election on June 22nd and the formation of a new government. But there has been no decision as to just how it will be done or whether foreign heads of state like President Carter will be invited. Bruce Dunning, CBS News, Tokyo.
Reports reaching India from Afghanistan now speak of savage clashes between rival factions of the Kremlin's puppet government in Kabul. One traveler who arrived in New Delhi yesterday said the opposing groups are fighting like crazy dogs. Soviet and Afghan army units are said to be tightening their security in the Kabul region. First the House and then the Senate yesterday finally approved the new compromise federal budget for fiscal year 1981, 4 weeks behind schedule. Mariah McLaughlin tells us that it's a good news and a not-so-good news situation.
The good news was that the Congress had, after much haggling, come up with a compromise budget resolution. The $613.1 billion spending plan contained $153.7 billion for defense. The same amount included in a previous proposal that was rejected. But this budget included an additional $300 million for domestic programs. That money taken from an anticipated $500 million surplus. Critics said the whole process was a sham, that the budget was balanced only on paper, and that the remaining $200 million surplus was a mirage. Not to go along with the compromise, said backers of it, could destroy the whole budget process, and that this could be the last compromise possible. The not-so-good news is that this is just a target budget that the Congress has labored over. The real one, the final budget, with revised figures, is due for approval in the fall. And with inflation continuing and unemployment rising, the pressure on the budget could force Congress to forego even the talk of balancing it. Mariah McLaughlin, CBS News, Capitol Hill.
The Senate yesterday approved President Carter's draft registration plan. The House, which already had passed it, will act next week on a minor change, and then the measure will go to the President for signature. Young men of 19 and 20 are expected to start registering with Selective Service in July. The American Civil Liberties Union, however, is still fighting the bill, saying it will argue in court that the plan's exclusion of women illegally discriminates against men. Mr. Carter wanted to include women, but Congress said no to that. The Democratic Platform Committee is holding another day of hearings in Washington, and Neil Strauser reports that it's going to be a long one.
It is still the time of listening for the platform drafters. They will listen on and on and on today for a planned nonstop 13 hours on Friday the 13th. Hearing the platform proposals of senators, congressmen, Americans for Democratic Action, the Gray Panthers, the Association of Evangelicals, and a parade of other organizations. The committee yesterday heard the often diverse proposals of Carter and Kennedy spokesmen. But there was less discord in the air than might have been expected. Kennedy delegates were allowed some minor victories on rules changes, and both Democratic Chairman John White and White House domestic advisor Stuart Eisenstadt stressed party unity. Eisenstadt dropping from his text references that might have seemed critical of Senator Kennedy. There will be a final long day of hearings tomorrow. Then on Tuesday, the platform drafting process begins. In a 15-person subcommittee, which includes 9 Carter supporters, 5 Kennedy supporters, and 1 independent. In the drafting will come the test of whether the Kennedy views can be accommodated sufficiently or whether the discord will surface and pursue the party into a potentially disruptive convention. Neil Strauser, CBS News, Washington.
Industrial production has declined again. The Federal Reserve Board says the combined output of American factories, mines, and utilities fell 2.1% in May, and that came on the heels of a 2% drop in April. The Fed says reductions in output occurred in all the major marketing groupings, and they were particularly sizable for automotive products, home goods, construction supplies, and durable goods materials. Gold went up over the $600 mark today on the foreign markets. It was fixed in London at $609.25 an ounce. The dollar is down, presumably because of the latest drop in U.S. interest rates. Britain today ordered the head of the Libyan mission in London to leave the country on the strength of reports that he'd issued a death threat against 2 Libyan exiles in Britain. The Libyan official was summoned to the Foreign Office and told that his presence was no longer in the interests of Anglo-Libyan relations.
CBS News, common market leaders meeting in Venice say the Palestinians must be included in future Mideast peace negotiations. I'm Mitchell Krause reporting on the CBS Radio Network. The leaders of the West European nations and Japan at the end of their 2-day summit declared that they recognize the right to existence of all states in the area, including Israel, and justice for all peoples. But this must apply to all parties, including the Palestinians. Israel opposes Palestinian participation in formal peace talks, and the U.S. has refused to meet with representatives of the Palestine Liberation Organization. Reaction to the common market action is expected from Secretary of State Muskie, who holds a news conference shortly in Washington. New problems in Britain's tenuous relations with Libya, the oil-rich North African state. Susan Peterson reports from London.
The British government decided to expel the head of the Libyan mission from Britain after he reportedly said he approved the assassination of 2 more Libyan exiles living in London. In a front-page story in today's London Times, the Secretary of Libya's self-styled People's Bureau embassy said that Libyan revolutionary committees based in Britain decided to kill 2 more opponents of Colonel Gaddafi's regime. I approve of this, the diplomat added. 2 Libyan nationals were assassinated in London earlier this year. Soon after, the British government expelled 4 other Libyan diplomats and announced this latest expulsion in Parliament this afternoon. In the same article, the expelled diplomat warned that Libyan revolutionaries may start to cooperate with the IRA, the Irish Republican Army, if the British government continues to support Libyans now hiding in Britain. Susan Peterson, CBS News, London.
The latest on Mount St. Helens after this.
Here he comes.
The winner of the 1980 Indy 500 crosses the finish line. Yes, it's Johnny Rutherford in that beautiful bright yellow Pennzoil Chaparral, taking the checkered flag for his third win. Jim Hall, owner and designer of the winning car, talks about winning at Indy.
One of the really important things is to have the backing of our major sponsor, Pennzoil. They've backed us all the way, and we think we've got a great team. The other important thing about that is that their product is really superior, and it's important to us to have the best product in this engine that we can have.
And what does fast-moving Johnny Rutherford, the new Indy 500 champion, have to say about Pennzoil?
We have to give a big vote of confidence and thanks to Pennzoil for producing a product that helped put us in victory circle.
Pennzoil Motor Oil. A winning owner and a winning driver know that Pennzoil does all an oil can do. Pennzoil. We make it for your car, too. Ask for it.
Mount St. Helens erupted again during the night. Observers said a plume of smoke and volcanic ash was shot 10 miles into the air and looked like an atomic explosion. This time, the ash fallout hit Portland, Oregon's biggest city, and a limited state of emergency was put into effect. However, despite the fallout, Portland area residents are managing to get to work this morning, although slowly, according to Portland police officer Dave Cook.
Conditions are still somewhat hazardous in as much as there is a restriction to visibility. With the accumulation on windshields and a muddy effect on the windshields caused from the wipers, roads are also a little bit slippery.
Weather Bureau officials now say they believe the volcano has stopped spewing ash and smoke, at least temporarily.